Goodness me, where have you all come from? thanks so much for being here today. My name is Shane McLeod from the Lowy Institute. I'd like to thank you for being here. Very first thing I'd like to do is acknowledge the traditional owners of the land that we're meeting on here today, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present. I'd like to thank you all for being here as well for this Lowy Institute event. And I'd like to thank my co-presenter today, Ben Bohane, for being part of it. I should introduce myself. I'm Shane McLeod. Did I do that part? Shane McLeod from the Pacific Islands program here at the Lowy Institute. Ben Bohane is a journalist and photographer with, I'm told, because we've just been talking about this, almost exactly 30 years' experience covering conflicts, traditional culture, and policy around the world, and in particular around the Pacific. And it's our pleasure here at the Lowy Institute to welcome Ben. Ben is the author of a forthcoming research paper looking at Bougainville and the coming referendum on Bougainville and the prospects for Bougainville after that vote. Now, I do need to let you know that that paper is not out in the wild just yet. We will be able to let you know as soon as it is. It's imminent. Ben has got a piece up on the Interpreter digital magazine today, which gives you a bit of a taste of what he's been observing and what will be in that paper. So I'd encourage you to get onto the Interpreter site today and have a look at that. Now today, Ben and I are going to have a bit of a conversation about Bougainville. We'll also have an opportunity for you perhaps to throw a question our way as well. Ben's research for this paper involved a trip back to Bougainville earlier this year, and he's got some fascinating observations to share with us. Before we get started, I just wanted to set the scene a little bit as well. In 2019, Bougainville is on the brink of historic change. In November this year, the people of the autonomous region will be voting in a referendum on independence. And that vote, formally, has been 2 decades in the making, but for many Bougainvillians, the hope for independence, the wish for independence, goes back decades before that. The vote is part of the peace agreement that ended the bloody decade-long conflict in the region that brought the closure of the Panguna mine and the reversal of some of the development gains that Bougainville had made in advance of other parts of PNG in many respects. And the violence and dislocation of that conflict is something that Bougainville is still dealing with. And this vote is a major part of putting that phase of Bougainville's history behind it. That said, the path ahead is not entirely clear. As part of that peace agreement, PNG's parliament retains the sovereign right to respond to the vote, and it will have to ratify the outcome of the election. As the Bougainville expert Tony Regan noted last year, the majority of MPs in PNG's parliament were not members of that chamber when that peace agreement was finalised. So we're looking forward to Ben's paper as the observations of someone who spent many years reporting on Bougainville, from the conflict years through to the peace negotiations and the formation of the Autonomous Regions Government, and now to this vote. And I should also note, there's been a few logistical complications in what we had hoped to bring you with this conversation today. You may be aware that there were plans for PNG's Prime Minister to be in Bougainville this week, addressing Bougainville's Parliament, which was going to be quite a significant event. Unfortunately, that hasn't been able to happen. Why that's interesting, we were hoping to bring some people down from Bougainville to be able to speak with you today. Most people were actually needing to be in Bougainville, in Booker, for the Prime Minister's visit. Subsequently, the airport has been closed, so people weren't actually able to get out of Bougainville either. So the Prime Minister's visit's been delayed till September. And we hope in coming months too that we can bring a bit more focus to Bougainville and hopefully have some more events for you here at the Institute as well. Now, Ben Bohane. Thanks for being here.
Pleasure.
We've got some of Ben's photos on the screen behind us all the way through. All of these photographs are from Ben's collection. And you'll see there's a variety, some from the conflict years, some from history through those negotiations and through various peace negotiations, and also from Ben's most recent visit. Now, Ben, I was interested to start this conversation by asking you about flying into Europa Airport in 2019. And how that compares to the first time you went to Bougainville, and what you think's changed in those years.
Right, thanks, Shane. Look, big difference in the intervening 25 years or so. First time I went in was 94, and that was through the back door. I ran the naval blockade via the Solomon Islands. It was sort of the middle of the conflict, and the PNGDF, with Australian help, had put in a naval blockade of the whole island, which made it very difficult for medicines and wounded people getting in and out. So that was really the only way to get in to Bougainville back then, was running the blockade. And that was kind of pretty hairy. We landed at 1 a.m. on Corromera Beach, and because back then there were no communications, they weren't able to warn us not to land on that beach because the PNGDF had retaken it 2 days before. So ended up being a hot landing, gunshots going off. So I was fortunate that the BRA came down and met us on the beach, and then we ran up the beach and into the bush. And then I spent a month moving around Bougainville with the BRA and managed to get first pictures and interview with Francis Ona, the BRA leader, and did that as an exclusive for Time magazine. 25 years later, it was all very comfortable flying in on an Air New Guinea jet into Europa. I know there's issues with the Booker airfield, and occasionally there are issues with Kiata and Europa, but at least Air New Guinea is servicing, you know, up till now it has been servicing both of those airfields. And that's a really important kind of link for people in Bougainville to be able to come and go, you know, like that. Obviously, since the war, the naval blockade's finished, but they're certainly very keen on Bougainville to make sure that there are substantial air links and transport links in and out of Bougainville so it doesn't feel isolated as it was during the war.
And so being in Arawa in 2019, it's busy. What's going on?
It's a busy market, but you don't see a great deal of building going on. You know, there hasn't been huge developments going on there in the intervening 20 years. And to be honest, I think that's created a little bit of frustration in Bougainville, certainly among some of the former BRA leaders that I spoke to. There was a sense that, you know, we've had 20 years of a peace process, but there hasn't been a great deal of development that's gone in since then. The economy is still, you know, fairly marginal. So it's not like going back to other countries, Honiara or Moresby or some of these other big towns where you see incredible change that's happened over the last 20 years. Arawa is still a fairly sleepy, undeveloped mining town, ex-mining town.
And you were there earlier this year. The process, the work towards the referendum has been going on. As you were going around, as you're talking to people, what was the sense that people gave you about that referendum process and how they feel it's going?
In January this year, there was still quite a bit of uncertainty, maybe a bit of confusion. People didn't know where to register. There were still some really basic questions to be asked. A lot of that has been solved since then, and people have found, you know, where they need to register. There's a few more websites involved. But in January, yes, there was still quite a bit of confusion about how the process was going to play out, whether the ABG had enough funds to actually manage it. I know there was a great deal of frustration within the ABG in terms of the lack of funds that had been promised. But since then, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, the United Nations have all pretty much come to the party and chipped in for this referendum ahead. So that side of it is pretty much sorted. And I think most of the wards which will be responsible for the vote are pretty much in place. Obviously, one of the main things I wanted to find out, you know, in terms of gauging sentiment, was to get a sense of how people felt, how they were going to vote. And to be honest, I found it extremely difficult to find any Bougainvillean who said that they were going to vote to remain with Papua New Guinea. Even some of the former BRF, Bougainville Resistance Force, which was the militia set up in cooperation with the PNG Defence Force during the war. I mean, during the war, I did a few trips with the PNG Defence Force and the BRF. And so I was able to meet plenty of Bougainvillians then who were unsure about independence and because of tribal reasons and ethnic reasons had issues with the BRA. not least of which was their concern that most of the BRE leadership were Nasioi speaking from central Bougainville, and they wanted to make sure that any future independent Bougainville would be evenly represented across the areas, you know, from the atolls, North Bougainville, South Bougainville, etc. So back then there was a little bit more of a split. This time going back in January, I found pretty strong unity among all Bougainvillians wanting independence. To the extent that I was concerned with my report coming out, I really needed to find some Bougainvillians who could speak positively about staying with Papua New Guinea. And I was telling Shane an anecdote. It had been suggested to me that Mr. Somoza, who was a former BRF commander and MP, was one of the few who was still speaking strongly to remain with Papua New Guinea. And so I was arranging to meet up with him after Arawa to go up to Buka. And then 2 days before I got to Buka, New Dawn FM came out with a story with Mr. Somoza saying 100% for independence. So that took away an opportunity to get a Bougainville leader to speak to PNG, to speak about Bougainville remaining with PNG. I know, obviously, there's a lot of Bougainvillians who've married into Papua New Guinea. There'll be Bougainvillians living overseas who will have great affinity for Papua New Guinea. I'm just not sure that they're going to be in any numbers by the time the referendum rolls around. And we have to assume, given the situation now, you know, we're probably looking at a 75%, 80% plus vote for independence on the ground.
I'll come back to PNG's role pre and post-vote in a sec, but what do you think that message will be then to the rest of the world, to people who pay attention to this vote? If the vote is that kind of quantum, do you think there's any other path then for independence for Bougainville?
I think if we're facing a sort of 80% plus vote for independence, then it does get very tricky for Australia and Papua New Guinea. Both countries have cooperated and signed up to the Bougainville Peace Agreement. That is the sort of foundation document that gives us a bit of a roadmap to the future. It will be very hard to ignore that level of pro-independence sentiment on the ground. I'm really not sure how, you know, there are mechanisms to get past that if it is deemed a free and fair referendum that everyone signed up to. Papua New Guinea changed its constitution to allow this vote. So it is going to put PNG and Australia in a tricky position. I know on several levels they'd probably prefer to keep the status quo, but we're looking at a situation with potentially an overwhelming vote for independence, and I'm not sure, you know, what policy options there are to ignore that.
Do you think a vote, you know, with a majority that size, is that a vote on the relationship with PNG, or is it a vote, I guess, a positive, an affirmation to want to head in another direction? Like, would PNG interpret a vote of that strength as a negative for PNG or a vote against PNG?
I don't know that it's necessarily a vote against Papua New Guinea. I see it more as a vote for Bougainville and the sense that a 20-year peace process where custom reconciliation processes have been allowed to unfold, they've really worked hard on Bougainville itself to build a sense of unity and reconciliation. And it is one of the really extraordinary aspects, I think, of Melanesian culture and Melanesian custom, the ability to really put serious issues behind them, you know, killings and tribal paybacks and all sorts of things. And, there were, you know, a lot of really nasty things that happened during the war, even between villages and divided loyalties. So it is remarkable that over this 20-year peace process, a whole, you know, endless reconciliation ceremonies have taken place. They're still going on. And so I think that's built up a sense of unity, and to the extent that I think there's a recent group that's just been formed called the Veterans Group, and that takes no account of which side you fought on. And that's now become the main sort of umbrella group representing all the previous militant groups from all the different sides, so that, you know, they can speak more or less with one voice. So, you know, even if I go back to that, the point I made a little bit earlier, you know, during the war, I spent some time with the PNG Defence Force and also with their local BRF allies. And what surprised me when I was able to speak to the BRF guys away from the PNGDF, you know, why are you supporting PNG, etc. And all of them said it was really to do with payback issues, that, you know, they'd lost relatives in BRA attacks, and this concern that any future independent Bougainville will be dominated by the Nasioi speakers of central Bougainville. So it played into some very old ethnic and tribal issues. But I think a lot of that's been resolved. And certainly within, if you look at the ABG leadership, it's spread, you know, right across. John Momus is from the south. James Tannis is from central. Anyway, I could go on, but I think the ABG is a lot more representative now of all the different regions of Bougainville than it may have been 20 years ago. So that's gone some way to building a sense of unity.
So given the intention with the peace agreement was to provide that time, to provide 15 years from when, you know, things would settle down, there would be the election of Bougainville's government, and then 15 years later there would be this vote on whether to become independent or whether to remain part of PNG. Do you think the likely outcome, as you think it will be, of that vote is different in 2019 compared to what it would have been if the vote had happened in 2005, for example?
I think so. I think, you know, if we go back to 2005, we're only a few years out of the conflict, you probably would have had a slightly larger cohort of people undecided or prepared to stay with Papua New Guinea. I think since then there's been a growing sense of Bougainville nationalism. But also, if I'm really honest, I think PNG may have lost an opportunity to build those relations by denying the funds, by not, you know, at a time when PNG was pretty flush with cash from its resources sector, you know, five, 10 years ago, there may have been an opportunity then to splash the cash in Bougainville, go on a bit of a hearts and minds campaign. But there is a sense that PNG didn't do that. PNG didn't, for whatever reason, really go into Bougainville and try and bring them back into the fold. And in the last few years, you had John Momus as president of Bougainville basically accusing PNG of sabotaging the referendum and the peace process. I mean, that's how bad sort of relations got to. I think they're certainly on a much more even keel now with the new Merapi government. The new prime minister has signalled a lot more willingness to engage in the peace process and accept the referendum unfolding. Within the first week of the new Merapi government, they released funds for the referendum. They appointed Sepulka Temu as Bougainville minister, and that went down well in Bougainville. He's well regarded there. So the new government in PNG has, you know, put things perhaps on a bit more of an even keel than they were under O'Neill, but it might be kind of too late for Papua New Guinea to hold on in there.
And what about after a vote then? So Papua New Guinea's parliament will need to respond to this vote. If it's an overwhelming majority, if it's 75% of Bougainvillians say we want to be independent, what do you see as the options for PNG in responding to that?
This is where it gets tricky because, you know, there are few policy options available. If you're dealing with an overwhelming vote for independence, it's going to be pretty hard to put the genie back in the bottle at that stage. There may be a sentiment in PNG that they can, you know, kick the can down the road a little bit more and delay the ratification in Parliament. The problem there is that that runs the risk of Bougainville hardliners, maybe even the mainstream, coming up with a deadline for PNG to ratify the vote And if they don't, then we may be looking at a unilateral declaration of independence again. Bougainville's done it twice in the past. They did it in 1975, 2 weeks before PNG independence, as a way of trying to preempt rule from Port Moresby. Of course, it was ignored back then. And then in 91, there was another UDI. So it's happened in the past, and we need to be cognizant that that might be the other card that Bougainville plays if they feel like PNG is deliberately delaying ratification. So that's sort of the danger that we're all going to have to face if the PNG Parliament decides to delay any ratification. I guess from a Bougainville perspective, they might say, look, we'll give you 6 months or a year to ratify it. I mean, I had a few discussions with some of the leaders on Bougainville about what they would see as an acceptable sort of time frame. And I think they were all pretty concerned at the idea that, you know, an overwhelming vote would not be ratified within a year. That would start pushing Bougainville to look at options, one of which would be a UDI. And I guess the issue there is that in the past, when Australia was the main sort of security provider in the region, as we still are to an extent, there may have been room to sort of somehow keep it in the fold. But we're in a very different and more complex geopolitical environment now. I can also reveal that when I was there in January, I heard about a delegation of 10 Chinese who'd turned up, including a PLA brigadier, and they've put $1 billion on the table for Bougainville.
Are those official channels, do you think, or is that testing the waters?
They were meeting with the core group, which is an umbrella group representing all the factional leaders, and then I had it confirmed with General Sam Kawona.
But from the China side, is that, do you think, freelancing by people who want to find a pathway to Bougainville, or do you think there's something more official?
It's very hard to tell because I think the way they can operate can be quite opaque. They weren't making official representations to the ABG, but in a way that's part of what they tend to do in places like Bougainville and Africa and other places. They'll go for the strongmen. They'll look for who the militant leaders are because they figure that's where the power ultimately rests. And so that, I think that is complicating issues, you know, in terms of Australia's response. We need to be careful that, you know, if Bougainville does issue a UDI out of frustration that PNG has delayed ratification, then there is the potential for some Pacific countries and perhaps even China to recognise a UDI. And then we have a regional crisis. I just think it's worth sketching that out. There hasn't been a great deal of thought given to that transition period. I think people have tended to focus on whether Bougainville's referendum ready, whether everything's in place, how it's going to vote. I think we've probably got a better sense of that now, but what we don't have a sense of is that transition period and the post-ballot period. What's going to be acceptable to Bougainvillians and what's going to happen in the PNG Parliament? As you say, many MPs, because of the high turnover of the PNG Parliament, there's a lot of MPs who've never really had to deal with the Bougainville issue. They're new to it. We don't know how they're going to deal with it. Then you've got, you have to take on board how the sentiment within the Papua New Guinea Defence Force as well. Are there going to be, nationalist soldiers? Are there going to be nationalist MPs who want to try and find a way to hang on? These are all unknowns. I did have a conversation going back through Moresby after the Bougainville trip, and I met up with a couple of friends and contacts within the PNG Defence Force. And to my surprise, most of them seemed fairly philosophical about the way it was going to unfold. And from their perspective, they thought, on one level, we need to let Bougainville go so that we can concentrate on our western border. There's an 800-kilometre border with Indonesia that's pretty much wide open. The PNGDF has lacked resources and manpower to effectively patrol their western border. So some within the DF, I think, are of the mind that they'll never be able to retake Bougainville by force. We're better off letting it go and concentrating PNG's defence apparatus more on its western side than its eastern one.
What about the big regional powers in the Pacific? I'm thinking New Zealand has been a very prominent and supportive part of the peace process, and Australia obviously is very heavily involved. Suffered, I think, in early years from its perception that it was closer to PNG. Where do countries like New Zealand and Australia, how do they position themselves ahead of the vote? And then how do they respond if it is such a big vote in favour of independence?
New Zealand's played a critical role. It's obviously seen as a lot more neutral than Australia. Australia was complicit during the conflict, whereas New Zealand was able to come in and broker several of the main peace agreements, including the Burnham Agreement and the First Truce, the Lincoln Accords. And then New Zealand took the lead role on the ground as the truce monitoring group and then the peace monitoring group were deployed there. I think it's been a great example of Australia and New Zealand cooperation in dealing with a regional security issue of such import. You could say it's a bit of kind of good cop, bad cop routine, but it's worked to the extent that, you know, Australia's been able to be seen to be a loyal ally to Papua New Guinea, which is critical to Australia on many levels, while New Zealand's been able to play a bit more of a peace-broking role. And I guess New Zealand will be looking at it much like Australia about, you know, in terms of what's going to be their response in the face of an overwhelming vote. You know, what policy options are there beyond recognising that Bougainville is headed for independence?
What about other powers? I mean, one of the interesting things potentially in the aftermath of a vote is an overwhelming vote in favour of, say, independence, and then other countries around the world who perhaps haven't paid a lot of attention to the Bougainville peace process and understanding the fact that PNG's parliament has a voice in the resolution of this afterwards. I guess I'm thinking about other international powers that would have an interest and perhaps have a say in how the global response is to a Bougainville vote. I'm thinking, you know, if you think UN Security Council, Russia perhaps is the only one that has some, I guess, unexpected or potentially unexpected role to play. If you think of France, France is not going to be a country that's supporting independence off the bat in the Pacific. China has issues with separatist movements within its own borders. How do those big international powers, and what role do they have to play in responding to a Bougainville vote?
Sure, I guess, you know, the process ultimately will go before the United Nations for ratification as well. It's a bit hard to know. You know, we have a sense of perhaps what China's interests are. We also have a sense of what Indonesia's interests are. Russia is a lot more unknown. They haven't made any obvious signal or any obvious moves in so far as Bougainville's concerned. They're certainly involved in Fiji and Papua New Guinea and a bunch of other Pacific countries. But at this stage, I haven't heard anything about Russian interest. But yes, any new country in the world or in the region is going to provoke some interest in the major powers and how they respond to that.
So to come back to Australia then, we're here in Australia. Australia has a bit of a complicated relationship with Bougainville, but it's been, I think, post-Sandline particularly, it's certainly been a more positive involvement with Bougainville. How does Australia respond? How should Australia respond? Or how should it be preparing for its response?
Australia's in a tricky position. We have to walk a really kind of middle line through this without being seen to favour any side. So one side of me understands that Canberra's gone quiet a little bit on this, in the sense that it doesn't want to be seen to be taking sides. I think our policy has shifted somewhat, as someone sort of said to me when I was working on this report. Basically, we've moved from a position of being pro-PNG through the colonial period and including the war. We continued to provide training and equipment to the PNGDF. So we were never seen as neutral during the conflict. But I think Australia, by being so involved in several peacekeeping operations, helped to sort of balance the perspective on Australia a bit. And since then, Alexander Downer, when he was foreign minister, signalled that Australian policy had shifted somewhat to the extent that Australia's position now was to follow the terms of the Bougainville Peace Agreement as the key roadmap towards independence. And that would include, you know, the formation of an ABG and a referendum. So for Australia, I think there's not a great deal it can do before the referendum other than to remain engaged. The one thing I think Australia could think about doing is having the foreign minister at least articulate that Australia is now neutral in terms of the referendum itself, because there is a widespread perception on Bougainville that Australia remains pro-PNG, partly because Australia has not provided any signal to the contrary. So there is still a great deal of suspicion on the ground about what Australia's position is. It's unknown from a Bougainville perspective. And I think we do need to be slightly concerned about that if we're going to be seen as the honest broker, and in case other powers are trying to woo Bougainville in the post-referendum period. I think it would suit Australia, I think it helps Australian policy to be seen from here on in as neutral in terms of the actual referendum. And then once that result is known, then obviously it's up to PNG and Bougainville to come to a negotiated settlement. Maybe Australia can take some of the blame for the conflict, so that gives Papua New Guinea a little bit of wiggle room. There are different sort of responses that can come out there. For now, yeah, that's what I would suggest. It's just a signal. Australia's not going to be favouring either side, but Australia's interests is to see a peaceful outcome to this long-running conflict. It's in Australia's interest to solve this within the Pacific family, and I think it's in Australia's interest to signal its neutrality from here on in to the people of Bougainville, without being seen to favour any side and wait for that referendum result.
I am going to lob an if question at you, so feel free to bat it away if you want to. But if it came down to a choice, if it came down to a disagreement between PNG and a Bougainville on the path to independence, does a relationship with Bougainville, does it get outweighed by the importance of Australia's relationship with PNG, given their scale, given their size, and given their relative importance in Australia's strategic relationships?
I think Australia is obligated to both peoples. There's a lot of history there. Bougainville was administered by Australia for 60 years. There's a lot of history there. I don't think, we can really sacrifice one people to keep good relations with Papua New Guinea. And I think the Australian relationship with Papua New Guinea is robust enough and long-term enough to get through this particular hurdle. I think PNG would also be, cognizant that Australia, as one of the main security providers in the region, is going to be concerned about any breakdown in peace there that would, potentially allow other external players to get involved. As I say, we're in a new geopolitical region situation, and it's going to be difficult to have Papua New Guinea ignore an overwhelming vote. Australia's going to have to use very careful diplomacy, But I think it you know, there's an argument that it may be in PNG's interests as well. It all depends how that negotiated outcome between Papua New Guinea and Bougainville goes. We may find that there's broad agreement and an understanding in Moresby that this has to be dealt with. Australia certainly shouldn't be seen to be kind of interfering at all. But it is incumbent on us as a regional power to try and keep the peace there, to follow the peace agreement wherever that leads, and hopefully there will be a negotiated outcome that will maintain that peace. And if that means potentially a new country in our region, then that's how it's going to go. There may be some other policy options which may be out there, but it's hard to see how Australia, New Zealand, PNG and the region can go against what's likely to be a free and fair referendum with a overwhelming majority voting for independence.
Ben, thanks very much for this part of the conversation. I'd now like to invite you here in the audience to be part of this discussion as well. Might start, I've got a colleague from the Lowy Institute. I'll keep it in-house for Ben Bland to ask the first one. Ben's from our Southeast Asia project.
Thanks, Shane, and thanks, Ben. Quick question. Do you think independence would make any difference to Bougainville's economic development prospects? Does it matter either way for its future economic development, whether it's independent or not, or do the same challenges still present either way?
That's a good question. I think, yes, it will make a difference. Bougainvillians are very keen to use the new mining powers which have been devolved to them. I should also point out that there's been a great deal of focus on the mining issue in Bougainville and whether that can help underwrite a newly independent country. What's less talked about is the fact that if we're looking at an independent Bougainville, we're also including the atolls, Nissen and Green Islands. If you were actually looking at the map and you were to factor in a 200-kilometre nautical mile boundary, an EEZ, it has incredibly rich fishing grounds as well. I've heard from some people that something like 40% of Papua New Guinea's annual fish catch is coming from Bougainville waters. That's worth $100 million a year. So even beyond mining, it's sitting on very rich fishing grounds. There's a history of agriculture and in particular cocoa plantations. And yeah, they're sitting on, a very significant deposit of copper, gold, silver beyond the Panguna mine. There's at least half a dozen other places. It can absolutely be a viable independent country if those resources are managed well. The big challenge, which I point out in the paper, is really about building that sense of unity, bringing integrity to the political process. But yes, I think on paper, Bougainville has all the natural resources, and if they were able to manage them themselves. The Mining Act of 2015 is a bit of a world first, actually. I mean, that's significant legislation in terms of its ability to empower local landowners to take much more control of their resources. And so the potential for communities to benefit a lot more from mining than they have in the past. I mean, if we go back to the days of BCL and RTZ, the landowners were receiving 5% of 1.5%. It's not a princely sum. So it's not surprising that landowners kind of arced up in terms of what they were receiving out of the Panguna mine. Now, I'd be wary of any miner that wanders in there that's not offering, less than 30% equity, just as a kind of general guide. So I think there is the potential for it to be economically self-sufficient if managed well.
Now, there's a gentleman here. Yeah.
David Guest from the University of Sydney. To follow that up, my understanding is that the ABG revenue is about 5.8% of its expenditure at the moment. So assuming there is a vote for independence, and I agree, if it's less than 90% vote for independence, I'd be surprised. But assuming there is a vote and Papua New Guinea may take the option of saying, OK, you're on your own, it's going to be, I mean, if you read the Jubilee Foundation's report on reopening the mine, it might be 20 or 30 years before they can expect any revenues from the mine. Cocoa certainly is a big potential source of income, so is fishery, but the lack of infrastructure kills selling those products. You just can't get them out of Quetta. What's going to happen? You know, you've got this incredible, well, all of a sudden there's no money. It's unlikely that there'll be significant income for decades. What are the risks that Bougainville may, if it does become independent, that it's a failed state? And what implications does that have for Australia and New Zealand, Indonesia, China?
Yeah, look, I mean, Panguna might take 10 years, to get up and running. There's already 5 or 6 mining exploration licenses that have been handed out. So there's money coming in from exploration, and it sounds like there will be a few new mines being added. That will add some income. The big issue, as you rightly raise, is going to be that transition period. And this is what I tried to get a sense of in January, talking to people. What was the idea that, yes, you can vote for independence, but you have to be ready that if PNG agrees to it, they're going to pull the plug. Your ships stop, your planes stop, your phone stops working. There's a whole range of basic services which potentially could stop. And so the big issue in these negotiated outcome that comes afterwards is about establishing what a transition period realistically could look like so that some of those essential services can be kept in place. Perhaps there's room for the Solomon Islands as well as an interested party and neighbour to assist Bougainville with some of that. But in terms of income, yes, I don't think anyone doubts that, there's some real issues there in terms of becoming a viable country, and that's why there's been such a focus on mining. I would balance that with the notion that I live in Vanuatu, been there 15 years. Vanuatu has the same population base, about 300,000 people, and no mining. It relies on tourism and agriculture. So from a regional perspective, you could argue, if Vanuatu survives with the same population base and no mining, then Bougainville equally has the potential to be a successful Melanesian country. I think it's obviously going to need assistance for the first 5, maybe even 10 years, until a lot of those economic opportunities come on stream. But the one thing I've found with Bougainvillians is they're very entrepreneurial. And they're all, they've sorted out all the trade stores on the islands. Even beyond the big mining projects, throughout the war, they were panning for gold. They're continuing to do that. The one thing that did surprise me going to Arrow was how many shiny four-wheel drives, brand new shiny four-wheel drives, were running around, doing the transport runs from Arrow up to Buka. I've heard estimates of anything between $50 and $100 million per year coming in from just alluvial gold panning. So, plus people survived during the war. They just returned to custom and their gardens. They're incredibly self-sufficient. So, and there is a strong sense of nationalism there that will drive them to find ways to survive as an independent country. No one doubts the challenges, least of all myself. And there's some real issues in terms of building consensus around mining because it's such a sensitive issue. There's going to be some real challenges ahead. But I think the Bougainvillians have pretty much made up their mind that whatever happens, they're better off trying to sort it out themselves and building their own revenue streams.
Yeah, my name's Greg Corner. Association and is married to a Petards Islander, which they call Buka, the mainland. Where do you see people, the warlords and so on, after independence? Are they going to make a grab for power? I've spoken to plenty of people who are fearful of that in the vacuum after an independent Bougainville. And an interesting thing, where do you see the Redskins that are living in Bougainville will be in a new Bougainville? Will they be expelled back to Papua New Guinea, or what's your opinion?
If I start with the presence of Papua New Guineans in Bougainville, I think if they're there now and they've been there for some time, they've probably been accepted into the community. They've, just like Bougainvillians have married Papua New Guineans and are living in PNG, you're going to have Papua New Guineans living on Bougainville who've been brought into the family. I'm not sure whether they're entitled to vote in this referendum. There's been some questions around that. But I don't think there's any issue with Papua New Guineans that have made Bougainville their home through marriage or business. There's not a lot of them, I'd have to say. And sorry, your other point was to talk about the warlords. Look, I think, you know, many of them have joined the kind of electoral process, if you like. General Sam Coona has run a couple of times in recent elections. Ishmael Tarama, who was, you know, one of the BRA's main commanders, has also run in elections. So I think many of them have adapted to an electoral system and realised that you can't be that strong man as you were in the war. There's always the risk if things deteriorated, yes, they could create some issues, but for now, there's a fair bit of confidence in the way the referendum's going to go and, you know, an electoral system in place that can handle the referendum, but also the election of a new Bougainville government. And that's something that we haven't quite addressed, but in 2020, there will be elections on Bougainville. And there's questions about whether, you know, the ABG still remains as the autonomous government Bougainville after a referendum, or what's the nomenclature, how to describe the Bougainville government post-referendum. But I think so far the signal's been from the warlords that they will, you know, join the electoral system and be prepared to win or lose office based on a democratic vote. Ishmael's lost two elections, Sam's lost two elections. They haven't tried to grab power. Megamui is another factor. They are one of the sort of wild cards in this sort of scenario. But I spoke to Moses Papiro, who's the Megamui Defence Force commander, in January, and he made it very clear that they had signalled to the ABG and to this core group, the umbrella group representing all the factions, that they were not going to intervene or disturb the electoral process. They are encouraging all their people to vote. They've quarantined their weapons, contained them. They haven't surrendered their weapons in the way that the other factions have, but they have contained them. And I saw a post 2 days ago with Sepuka Temu down with the Mekamui faction inspecting the way their weapons have been contained. So I don't think there's going to be issues with Mekamui Panguna. Another issue we haven't raised is the potential role of Noah Musinku,
our good friend Noah,
and Uvistract, the Mekamui Uvistract. They are potentially the only group that could create problems, or they are the most likely. In January, speaking to the core group, they said that Noah had been telling his followers not to vote in the referendum. He still has some ex-Fijian mercenaries who are training his army, his private army. And they're outside all the peace process. They're outside the containment of weapons. So in my main report, which probably comes out next week, I've sort of identified Mekamui Uvistract and Noamasinku as being potentially the main threat. If there is going to be any disturbances, it may well come from his faction. But they're not big enough to really overturn, you know, the main voting. They're certainly not big enough to take power. So they're a small faction that may have to be dealt with at some point. And it will be interesting to see whether they end up voting or whether they end up disturbing this process.
Any other questions before we wrap things up? Yes, up at the back there. Yes, thanks.
It's Sue Lennon from ABC. Thanks for this talk. It's excellent. Just what about in terms of aid? What will happen to PNG's aid budget? Are they for Australia's aid to PNG? Are they Australia likely to carve out some of that, which I guess PNG wouldn't like? And also, do you think New Zealand and Australia will chip in and help Bougainville in the transition period if independence goes ahead?
Thanks. My understanding is Australia's aid project in Bougainville is roughly $50 million a year. It goes towards some infrastructure like roads and bridges, health, education. There's a couple of hospitals. So Australia's, you know, been a pretty generous provider of aid to Bougainville through this whole process, and still remains the largest aid donor to Bougainville. That obviously comes out of the PNG budget, so there would potentially be changes in the event that Bougainville becomes independent. Maybe it means the PNG aid budget loses $50 million that it would have otherwise had. On that, there's also, I think, a need for a discussion around how Australia spends its aid money there. It's certainly going to important areas, health, education and infrastructure. I do think we could be a little bit more imaginative and actually work with Bougainvillians to help create actual products. One thing I notice living in the Pacific, and I think this plays into some of the geopolitical issues we're confronting, every day we have Australian container ships turning up to all the main ports around our region, Honiara, Port Moresby, Port Vila, Suva, full of Australian produce destined for their local supermarkets. Those ships pretty much return empty. And I think that's a real issue for Australia. If we're going to be dealing, you know, Pacific Islanders want trade. They're growing less and less comfortable with the idea that they are donor recipients of aid. They don't want to be seen as aid recipients because it plays into a whole other narrative about dependency and et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, in a case like Bougainville, if they're going to have rich fishing grounds, why not have a cannery? If you're sitting on, you know, major cocoa plantations, why not support a chocolate factory there so they can be making stuff locally? I think there's a whole range of areas that Australia could be investing in terms of quarantine, packaging, actually helping Bougainville and other Pacific countries create the products that they can then sell, so that it's a bit more of an even relationship. Sorry, I don't know whether that addressed some of your issues around the aid program. But yeah, it's about $50 million a year.
John Connor, I'm just curious about Indonesia. It would seem that Indonesia viscerally wouldn't be very happy. It can't be very happy with the idea of independence votes in far-flung islands, particularly given what's happened and continues to happen in Irian Jaya and elsewhere. Have they evidenced any interest in what's happening in Bougainville? If so, how?
Yes, this is an issue I've tried to dig into a little bit. It's incredibly difficult to get any sort of official response out of Indonesia. But certainly the feeling on the ground in Bougainville and speaking to people within the PNG government, I was made aware that there had been a little bit of subtle pressure, certainly under the O'Neill government. I think we do have to take it as a given that Indonesia is concerned at the prospect of a successful referendum in Bougainville leading to independence, because it would then create a regional precedent for West Papua. And everyone in Bougainville is aware of that. I think there's also people in Moresby who are aware of it. I'm not sure if that's so well understood here in Australia, but we do absolutely have to consider that Indonesia has concerns and interests around Bougainville, and that can play into, you know, what's going to happen there. I don't think Indonesia is going to get too involved. It's aware that it probably has a bit less leverage under the new Merapi government than they did under O'Neill, certainly since the foreign minister, Rimbing Parto, has been replaced. He was very amenable to Indonesian interests, shall we say, on a whole range of issues. So having a new government in Moresby might firewall PNG and Bougainville somewhat against those Indonesian pressures. But yeah, we certainly shouldn't discount that Indonesia has potential interests there as well, and views.
We will bring things to a close there. I'm sure you'll agree there's plenty to talk about when it comes to Bougainville. Here at the Lowy Institute, we'll be continuing a focus on this over the next couple of months. We look forward to bringing you some more opportunities to engage with the issues around Bougainville. As mentioned, Ben's paper will be published in the next short while, and each of you here today will let you know when that paper is available for you to read on our website. Ben, thank you very much for being part of this conversation today. We've taken advantage of the fact that Ben's on his way back through Sydney, on his way back home to Vanuatu. And thank you each, ladies and gentlemen, for being here today and being part of our event. We appreciate your time. Thanks a lot.